Our story begins one fine spring morning, March the 25th, 1931, on a boxcar headed for Memphis. And nine young boys, nine complete strangers, are about to begin the ride of their lives. Go on, boys, flavor us with your story. Tell us where it all started.
From the Candor and Ebb musical, The Scottsboro Boys, a fitting way to introduce our show this evening. Hi, I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is a novel idea. Alabama, during most of the 20th century, was the epicenter of America's visceral, moral, political, and personal working out of who we are as a country. How fitting that as we approach the upcoming presidential election, which continues to play out our national struggle for identity, that we feature Rosemary Manchester in conversation with Waits Taylor Jr. on his book, Our Southern Home, Scottsboro to Montgomery to Birmingham, The Transformation of the South in the 20th Century. We'll also feature a musical tribute to Alabamian and the player to break Babe Ruth's all-time home run record, Hank Aaron. We will also bring you a reflection by violist with the San Francisco Symphony, Southerner and Alabama expatriate, Wayne Roden. So please stay tuned. It's a novel idea.
Good evening and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester, and I'm delighted to have in the studio with me this evening, Waits Taylor Jr. Waits has just published a book called Our Southern Home, one of the finest books I've read in a long time, and certainly the finest on the topic of the civil rights movement in the South. Waits, I'm so happy to have you here to talk about this book.
Well, thank you, Rosemary. It's a delight to be here and an honor to be here.
Well,
thank you.
You know I love your book because I've already told you that.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And so much work went into this.
Oh, absolutely.
How many years?
5 to 7 years. Mm-hmm. And from the moment I started on what came to be the book, it was an intense period of research, traveling to the South, to Washington, D.C., the Library of Congress, New York City, et cetera, to visit libraries, archives, interview people, collect material, get court records, court transcripts, books that I needed to reference in the work I did. So the first part was an extensive exercise of research, reading, and sorting out how I wanted to condense this material in the form that I wanted to use it. And then it was a process of writing, rewriting, rearranging, re-editing, you know, all the things that writers go through. Mm-hmm. The book was published in October 2011.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I understand from what I read at the beginning of the book, you had a book pretty much complete in 2004. And then you got new information, which led you to, I guess, completely rewrite the book?
Well, essentially, in 2004, I had finished writing what one would call a more conventional memoir about my family's story in the South. And that story was wrapped around the segregation period and civil rights period, of course. But it was that story. And then in October 2004, I got out of the blue an email from a woman named Laura Anderson, who is an archivist at the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute. In paraphrasing, she said she was looking for a person named Waits Taylor with a rather unusual first name, and if I was that person or related to him, please email her back. She had some interesting information she'd like to share. And, of course, I immediately emailed her back and said I was Waits Taylor Jr., the son of the person I'm sure she was looking for. Laura Anderson has since become a very good friend, but what I learned from her was information about my father's past that I was not aware of, and that is that he became the executive secretary of the Alabama Scottsboro Committee in 1935, a group of prominent white Alabamians who tried to ensure the Scottsboro Boys got a fair trial. I mean, I literally put the other manuscript aside, and that's when the effort that I described a moment ago started.
That's amazing. And, you know, if if you'd written a work of fiction, that would seem so unlikely that people would say, nah, couldn't happen.
Well, that's right. It, mm-hmm. You know, the truth is stranger in fiction,
that's
as
right.
they say.
And that led you to the story of the Rasmussens, most interesting couple. Would you just tell us a bit about them?
Actually, the way I truly became aware of Dad's involvement in it was because of the Rasmussens. Laurie and Don Rasmussen were a young couple who both graduated from the University of Illinois, Urbana. She had emigrated to the U.S. out of Nazi Germany in around 1937. They were both very committed liberals and were even involved in civil rights activities when they were in the university. When they graduated and got married, they moved to Talladega, Alabama, and taught at the all-black Talladega College in 1942. You can't imagine what an act of bravery and risk that was in that period of time. They never suffered any grievous mistreatment, but in fact, in one incident in Birmingham, they were arrested for having eating with a black man in a black restaurant because that was against the segregated laws in Birmingham. That's a fascinating story in and of itself. But Don, to finish his dissertation for his PhD, decided to do a study of Southern customs and thoughts on racism. And he wanted to interview a number of white Alabamians thought to be liberal, and you might put quotes around that, on the race question. And one of the 50 or 55 people he interviewed was my father. And it was actually from those interview notes that I learned Dad was involved in the Scottsboro Boys events. Mm-hmm. And Don, Laurie died a few years ago, but Don had his 95th birthday party in Berkeley a few months ago, and I was there. It was a wonderful day.
Amazing.
And I read the passages in the book about Don and Laurie, and there wasn't a dry eye in the house.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Are young people in the South today aware of the fact that it used to be a crime for black and white people to sit down and have a meal together?
The answer is yes and no. I'll relate a couple of interesting things that happened when I was on one of my two book tours in Alabama earlier this year. I gave lectures and readings at the University of Alabama and two at the University of West Alabama in Livingston, Alabama. And what I loved, the audience was about 50-50 black and white, which when I was at the University of Alabama, believe me, it was all white. Mm-hmm. And very engaged. I was very well received everywhere I went in the state, both personally and my book. But after both of these readings at both universities, a few the black students came up to me and said, "Mr. Taylor, I didn't realize how bad it was." Well, these are black children brought up in black households, and the stories just had not been passed on to them, or their history classes hadn't covered in enough detail to bring home all of the events that I was talking about and describing. And that really threw me off my heels at first, but then I got to thinking about it. Think about when you were in university and you were 18 or 20 years old, and if you thought back 50 or 60 years ago, which is what we're looking at now, to what was going on in the world at the time you were that age, you sort of knew about it on the surface, but you didn't know the details about it. Mm-hmm. And these young people are in that same boat. So there's good news and bad news about that. One, they need to know their history, mm-hmm. and that's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book and continue telling the stories. But two, it does illustrate that with the generations, we move away from some of those grievous moments of the past and things do start to improve.
But we must not forget.
We absolutely, like the Holocaust,
that's
like
right.
any terrible
Never
event
forget.
In our history, mm-hmm. as they mm-hmm. continue to unfold in the Middle East and other parts of the world today.
Well, I hope that your book will – I don't want to call it a textbook because that sounds dull, and your book is anything but dull, but I would love to see it as required reading in schools throughout the South and the North. I mean, through it's mm-hmm. – you know, we Northerners get so smug about the fact that, well, we didn't do anything wrong, but
excuse me?
Yes, I know. I you are a Southerner yourself, and so you must run into this all the time. Mm-hmm. Yes, the smug Northerners. Yes. At the point at which your father came into the story, then you had your magic number of three, mm-hmm. because the number three is so important in this story. There are three important protagonists. There are three regions, and when I look at the cover of your book, immediately I see the importance of three: our southern home, Scottsboro, to Montgomery, to Birmingham. There's three. I see pictures on the cover of three people. Mm-hmm. Since our listeners can't see the cover, perhaps you'd tell us the three people who are prominently pictured on the cover.
Okay. And in addition, the title also says Scottsboro to Montgomery to Birmingham, three cities.
That's right.
The three individuals are, one, Clarence Norris, mm-hmm. who was one of the nine Scottsboro boys, who was 18 years old on March 25th, 1931, when the event started. The second person in the center of the – I call it a triptych.
A triptych, of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the center photo in a triptych painting is the most important. And in this case, that person is Rosa Parks.
Yes.
And, of course, we don't need to introduce her to your audience,
right.
I'm sure. But it is because of that woman's actions that the modern civil rights revolution started. And what readers will see when you read it, readers, in the background is Martin Luther King Jr.
Yes.
And it was this woman's actions that led to the emergence of Martin Luther King as the charismatic leader of the civil rights mm-hmm. movement. The third person in the triptych is my father, Waits Taylor Sr., who became the executive secretary of the Alabama Scottsboro Committee, as I mentioned. And one of the theses in my books is that the Scottsboro boys' events and trials, and they were tragic and unjust, but they represented the nadir, the low point in Alabama's segregated history. Because out of those events, Rosa Parks married a young man named Raymond Parks, who was a member of the NAACP in Montgomery. And he and a group of black men were quietly raising money for the defense of the Scottsboro boys. Rosa, when she met him, learned of the Scottsboro events from Raymond, and her growth as an activist started from that moment forward. And there are many others described in the book who added to that growth, to that monumental day in 1955 when she refused to move from her seat on the bus. And then my father's involvement. But beyond Rosa, the three cities, Scottsboro is where the trials started, Montgomery is where the bus boycott took place, and Birmingham is where Martin Luther King led the demonstrations in 1963, which culminated in the tragic bombing murder of those four young black girls. Those three cities, and including Selma, Alabama, with the march in 64, were the ultimate events that led to the creation of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And if you look at history up to that point in the 20th century, the changes and segregation and the laws and even the morality of it had changed very little. But once the federal government finally really got involved and passed these two laws, it was like a massive tsunami swept over the South and the nation. And within 10 to 20 years, all legal and signed vestiges of segregation were gone. Of course, not the underlying core of racism and hatred. That is even still with us today.
Right.
I see it, at least in what I've observed, to be less than it was. But we've got some work to do in that regard. Great social moral change takes a long period to finally affect that change, but we finally got it moving in the right direction.
And Rosa Parks as the change agent for an action that must have seemed almost insignificant. I mean, a tremendous significance. But you think of the way we write history. We think of battles, and we think of great events and legislation. And here the change agent is a lady who refused to move from her seat on the bus.
Right.
And it's just astonishing the way you bring Rosa Parks into focus. You take your time with it. And now we're going to talk a little bit about the Scottsboro Boys, because there may be people out there who are thinking, Scottsboro, I've heard. Now, who were the Scottsboro Boys? When I started reading your section of the book about the Scottsboro Boys, I literally could not put the book down. It's a long, long section of the book. And I was just turning those pages. It was riveting. And I was indignant at what they were subjected to. And it was as though I were watching those trials, as though I were there. So it's really unkind to ask you to summarize that beautiful long passage. But just to make sure that everybody knows who they were.
Well, let me try to summarize it briefly. On March 25th, 1931, a freight train left Chattanooga, Tennessee, bound for Memphis, Tennessee. A group of young black boys, quite young, and a group of young white boys jumped on the train to hobo to various points along the route. Also, two young white girls jumped on the train, 17-year-old Ruby Bates and 21-year-old Victoria Price. And it's their presence on their train makes this tragic story. Soon after the train left Chattanooga, it was a cool March morning, unseasonably cool. All the cars were open cars. And a fight broke out between the group of black boys and white boys for space on the best covered car on the train. The black guys prevailed, and the train was going slow in these first parts, and they ejected all but one of the white guys off the train. And the white guys immediately walked to the closest station, which wasn't that far away, complained to the station master, who called the sheriff. All a white had to do in those days was complain about a black person offending them or attacking them, and all hell broke loose. The sheriff put together a posse. It stopped the train a ways out of Scottsboro, arrested the nine black guys. About that time, the two young white gals got off the train and tried to slink away, because they were all breaking the law by hoboing on the train, and pulled them over. And at first, the white girl said nothing. Then finally, one of them, and I'm pretty sure it was probably Victoria Price, said, "Them nine black boys had their way with us." And that turned everything. To the deputy sheriff's credit, who was leading the posse, he prevented those nine boys from being lynched on the spot. They took them to Scottsboro, and over the next 13 to 15 days, a grand jury was convened, issued, charges against them. And in a three-day period of time, there were four trials in a revolving door-type fashion, where they were found guilty, 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 sentenced to die in the electric chair. The judge assigned the counsel to them 30 minutes before the trial started, and the guy at counsel had 15 minutes to talk to them. Everything about the trial was egregious. Victoria Price was the chief prosecution witness, and she continued to be throughout the 11 trials that took place over the next 7 years. None of the boys was ultimately executed, but their lives had completely been ruined. Several of them had very tragic lives after they finally got out of prison, died tragically. Clarence Norris, who was the person I mentioned on the cover of the book, was the last surviving Scottsboro boy, and the state of Alabama finally granted him a full pardon in 1976, and none other than George Wallace signed the pardon.
Amazing.
Yes.
Amazing.
Well, everything that could go wrong went wrong, and there were a few brighter moments in the trial, like Judge Horton, but we had the Communist Party, the ACLU, the NAACP, a New York Jewish lawyer, all kinds of things mixed in to the melange of what made up Scottsboro Boy situation. And from a writer's standpoint, it was a rich minefield of things to work with, but it presents a tragic, tragic event in our country's history.
Now, you're the only person who could have written this book because of being a Southerner yourself. And, you know, there's a great suspicion of Northerners who come down and you know, write their books about how bad the South is. Was it hard to make these revelations about, you know, it was really your Southern home?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yes, it was hard.
Yeah, but
I write a few personal stories in there about things I observed and was involved in and didn't take some actions and things that I wish I had and that I'm still ashamed of. So, yes, it was hard. When I wrote some of the passages in the book, you know, I'd tear up just writing them. And still to this day can't read parts of the book without getting emotional about it.
I wanted to ask you something about Scottsboro Boys. Do I recall that there was a musical comedy not too long ago about the Scottsboro Boys?
Yes, there was. I saw the—
You saw it. Okay.
Well, it's not a musical comedy.
Let me
explain it to you.
All right.
I've seen it three times. I saw it in New York on Broadway and saw it twice in San Francisco. And, in fact, it was at ACT in San Francisco, American Conservatory Theater on Gary. And I was asked to be on a radio program with one of the actors prior to it being produced. So for that, they invited my wife and I to be their guest at the opening event, which was wonderful. When you first hear the premise of the play— It's done in minstrel show style format. You have the reaction you did, that it's a comedy, that it's a farce. And when I first heard it, that's what I thought too. How can they do that?
Exactly.
Debase
this
terribly important story. Well, the musical was written by Kander and Ebbs, who have very strong credentials. They did Chicago, Cabaret, The Kiss of the Spider Woman. And this is their last play. Ebb died a few years ago. The minstrel show is a vehicle to tell the story. And when the play opens, you see a black woman sitting on a bench, quietly waiting for a bus. It's 1955. It's Rosa Parks.
Oh my God.
And if you don't understand this, you miss the structure of the play. And she dozes off and starts reminiscing about the past. And she knew very much about the Scottsboro Boys. In fact, she went to one of the prisons and met a few of them at once. And all of a sudden, you hear this minstrel show-type music, and the nine Scottsboro Boys come out dancing. And it's a minstrel show-type thing, and they present themselves to Rosa Parks. And then the one white actor in the play, who is the interlocutor, which in a minstrel show was the way it was done, comes out and says, "We're going to tell the story tonight of the Scottsboro Boys." And one of the black actors, playing one of the boys, comes up and says, "Well, for a change tonight, could we tell the truth?" And then there's Mr. Tambo and Mr. Bones, who are the almost like Commedia dell'arte characters in a minstrel show, look at each other in surprise. "The truth? I don't know what the truth is." And then they go on to tell the Scottsboro Boy story truthfully, but in a minstrel show with dance, song, and it's a great vehicle for young black actors. They were magnificent. And the play ends on December 1, 1955, in a scene when Rosa Parks refuses to move from her seat, and then the curtain comes down. So what sounds like a musical comedy is a wonderful, wonderful musical drama.
I'm so glad I asked you, because, you know, I couldn't imagine, and now I can. Did you ever think of doing your book as historical fiction?
I thought about that, and a couple of people suggested that to me along the way. And some suggested I even break it into two parts. Initially, it was much longer than it was. I had to edit it down. But no, while thinking about it, I never seriously considered it.
No, I think this is exactly the medium.
Now, what I did try to do in writing it was to tell it in a more story narrative style,
yes. Mm-hmm.
To break from the classical history book, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how well I've succeeded in that, but that was my intention.
I think you succeeded admirably because I realized that the narrator had a stake in this story.
Mm-hmm.
And that feeling in the voice of the narrator came through to me. And it wasn't, pay attention, this is important. It was, I want to share this story with you. And, of course, that for the reader, that's exactly what they want. They mm-hmm. want the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that.
We'll be back with more of Rosemary Manchester and Waits Taylor. But now let's take a short break and listen to Peter Cooper's Anthem to Hank Aaron. And later in the show, we'll hear a Southerner's Reflection by musician Wayne Roden. Stay with us.
Dice came zinning with a flash of a blade. It's all in the wrist if you want to get paid. Daddy sold beer at the Black Cat Lounge. Sold a little shine till the man come around. Little boy walking to a place like that. Hidden bottle caps with a broomstick bat. Skinny cause there wasn't much of nothing to eat. Walking through the mud cause there wasn't any street. This was Alabama, down the bay, with the whole world looking off the other way. Henry Aaron was looking for a reason to dream in 47 when a black man signed with a big league team. Jim Crow smiling while the sun beat down on a sandlot field on the wrong side of town. He took it all in stride, striding to the ball. Turn of the wrist, crack, jog and touch them all. Ten years later, still playing the game with stands full of people screaming out his name. He won the pennant for the Braves with a four-base knock the same day they were riding in Little Rock. Up in old Milwaukee, he was MVP. Back in Alabama, he was still not free. Not free to drink a beer in the white folks' lounge. Not free to have a meal in Mobile downtown. A young man rising from the hard, hot South. Speaking his mind with his bat and not his mouth. Holding it inside, striding to the ball. Turn of the wrist, crack, jog and touch them all. Crack, jog and touch them all. Hank Aaron, he kept on hitting home runs. A lot of them. The Braves moved from Milwaukee to Atlanta, not far from his home of Alabama, the place he'd escaped from, and he kept on hitting them. And after a while, people started to think that he wasn't hitting home runs so much as he was chasing a pinstripe ghost named Babe Ruth, the holder of the all-time home run record, the greatest record in all of sports. He had 714 of those, and they weren't little piddly things. They were mammoth, moonshot home runs. He would stand at home plate, watch the ball sail over the fence while his big belly jiggled and danced around from the aftershock of the blast. Babe didn't do performance-enhancing drugs, you know. He did performance-restricting drugs, like wine, women, and song. And he was loud, and he would brag, and he was funny, and he was white. And Hank Aaron was none of those things. He just shut up and hit home runs. And some people clapped when he hit him, but others threatened to kill him. They sent him hate mail. They threatened to gun him down for being a good baseball player, for being maybe even a better player than Babe Ruth was, and for challenging Babe Ruth's home run record, the greatest record in all the sports. But Hank beat it, and the day he beat it, on April 8th, 1974, his mama was there to meet him at home plate. Reporters crowded around and kept asking her how it felt to be the mother of the all-time home run king, and she just kept shouting, "I don't know, I don't know, I don't know." I remember one time I was a little kid in a beauty salon in Atlanta waiting on my grandmother while she got her hair done. I had on a Braves shirt. The lady there asked me who my favorite player was, and I said, "Hank Aaron." And she said it was too bad that he had broken that record and that it didn't look like they were ever going to let us keep anything for ourselves. Now, I didn't know this lady and I had any part of that home run record, so I was confused as to how Hank Aaron had taken it away from us. Anyway, I can't remember that lady's name. I never read anything about her in a book or a magazine. I never saw her on TV. Hank Aaron did pretty good for himself, though. Pretty good. But I think it must have bugged him. I think maybe it shocked him that the more truth and beauty he put out there into this world, the more lies and ugliness came right back at him. Maybe that's the way it works sometimes. Maybe that's the way it works a lot of the time. Maybe that's the way it works. Dice games ending with a flash of a blade. It's all in the wrist if you want to get paid. Daddy sold beer at the Black Cat Lounge. He sold a little shine till a man came around. Little boy walking through a place like that, hitting bottle caps with a broomstick bat. Skinny cause there wasn't much of nothing to eat. He was walking through the mud cause there wasn't any street. That was Alabama down the bay. Whole world looking off the other way. And Henry Aaron was looking for a reason to dream. And when the dream came true, that's when the world got really mean. Opened up death threats in the mail cause he was taking a hammer to a great white whale. He had no place to hide, striding to the ball. Turn of the wrist, crack, jog and touch them all.
You've been listening to crack, Peter Cooper with his 715 for Hank Aaron. Featured on Freight Train Boogie 2, a collection of Americana music, which you can pick up at the Last Record Store in Santa Rosa. All proceeds benefit KRCB Radio. Stay tuned for musician Wayne Roden, viola player with the San Francisco Symphony and native Alabamian, as he reflects on his life as a Southerner. Right now, let's return to Rosemary Manchester in conversation with Waits Taylor Jr. about his book, Our Southern Home.
At one point, you said that you reminded yourself of Jim in To Kill a Mockingbird. Do you think that Harper Lee, she must have been influenced by the Scottsboro Boys and those endless trials, and surely she knew about them, but to your knowledge, did she ever say that the Scottsboro Boys were in her mind when she wrote Mockingbird?
Well, I'm sure as you well know, Rosemary, Harper Lee has been very cloistered since she moved back to Alabama after she wrote Mockingbird, her singular and only book. So she said little to that question, but what I've been able to determine from what I've read is she certainly knew of the Scottsboro Boys case. Some pundits have said she even fashioned the judge in the case after Judge Horton, who was the only good judge of the three that tried the Scottsboro Boys. And that's an interesting story, what Judge Horton did. It was rather courageous. I don't think that's so. I think it's most likely that she patterned him after her father, who was a judge, and apparently had a similar trial with a young black guy accused of rape when she was young, or possibly before he was born. I can't remember the details of the timing. I think that's the more likely proposition.
It makes me think of what Malcolm Gladwell calls the tipping point. Mm-hmm. In both the story of the Scottsboro Boys and the story of Rosa Parks, mm-hmm. that indignities and atrocities, lynchings, were committed over a number of years. And finally, something in the case of the Scottsboro Boys, something happened that was so terrible that it must have caught the attention of, well, who knows how these things happen, but things began to change. In the case of Rosa Parks, what she did was so slight. It's like the butterfly that affects the climate.
Yes.
And that was the, because of her, the story got to Dr. King, and then it began to have an effect on the entire South. It's just amazing to look back on how those things get started.
It is, and you're right. And the tipping point is a good term, or hinge point, whichever mm-hmm. you prefer. Rosa's courage that day is certainly one of them. Another one is the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act.
Mm-hmm.
A huge tipping point in our history.
Mm-hmm.
Not only finally moving us away from the terrible vestiges of segregation, and finally even the connections back to slavery, but it led to the political changes in this country, where the South turned to the Republican Party, especially after the Voting Rights Act, and changed the political landscape of this country. And Lyndon Johnson reportedly famously said when he signed the Voting Rights Act, "I just gave the South away for 50 years."
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's almost 50 years, Lyndon, and I think it may go longer than that.
Right.
On that point,
right.
There's a world premiere play called All the Way, playing at Ashland, Oregon now, about Lyndon Johnson's first year in office and the efforts that he went through to get the Civil Rights Act approved and passed. And Lyndon Johnson, for all his weaknesses, was probably the man to do that because of his knowledge of the Senate rules, and his ability not to take no for an answer. He was a bully, a cajoler. He'd do anything he could to win the day. And he knew the Senate rules so well to box in the Southern senators, of course, who had great power because of their committee chairmanships and the filibuster. And that is what the play is about. And I'm going to see it in about a little over a week. I can't wait.
It sounds like an amazing play.
Yes.
Now, your dad was a journalist, and he ran a newspaper called Our Southern Home. Did I ask you before how he got involved with the Scottsboro Boys?
My dad had just graduated from the University of Alabama, and so in 1935 or 6, he was 23 or 24 years old, and had just started working in Birmingham. And the minister and founder of our church, Independent Presbyterian Church, a guy named Dr. Henry Edmonds, who was quite socially and politically liberal for the times, wanted to form this committee to try to get prominent Alabamians to support his point of view. But he needed someone to help with the legwork. So he turned to my dad and asked him to be the executive secretary, and Dad agreed to do it. And when you read some of Don Rasmussen's notes, my dad says that he didn't do it because he was burning up over the Scottsboro issue. It was more because his minister had asked him to do it. Another sidebar, my dad started as an FDR liberal, ended his life as a neoconservative, and that's another small substory in the plot, trying for me to come to understand that transformation. But in any case, he agreed to do it, and they were quite successful. They got 50 or 55 prominent Alabamians to support this position. He was paid $37.50 a week plus travel expenses for his effort, which I think during the Great Depression was probably pretty good.
Yep.
Just to be working was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And they had limited success with their committee in terms of influencing the change or the stoppage of the trials, because it was such a tug of war between the Communist Party, the ILD, the International Labor Defense, which was the legal arm of the Communist Party, the NAACP, the ACLU, to try to affect the changes they wanted. And the groups just could not get together. And that's another of the substories in the book about all the things that were going on in the background about these groups trying to control the trial, almost ignoring the real problem, the nine boys.
Yes.
And what was going on with
them. The boys almost got lost.
They get lost in the arm twisting and the interceding fights between these groups. So that was how he became involved in it.
Yeah. Do you suppose it was that experience that made him think, well, the heck with the liberals?
No, I don't think that was the moment. I think it started when he was called back into the Army in 1950. Oh. He was a reserve officer in World War II, got out as a captain, and then when the Korean War started, he was called back in. And then because of his age and where he was with his career, he decided to stay in the Army until he got his retirement. And the Army's a very conservative.
Yes.
And that's when I started to observe and feel and sense changes from that point forward. But what I finally concluded after reading some of the editorials he'd written when he was editing and running our Southern Home from 1949 to 52 was that my dad was not quite as liberal, even when he was young, as I had perceived him as a child, and I even took that forward till I read this background material.
And it's all relative. He could have been more liberal than the people around him.
Oh, no doubt.
He's still not very liberal.
No question he was.
Right.
Because I never experienced in my family anyone mistreating a black person or speaking negatively of them. In fact, once when I was very young, I said something nasty to one of our black maids, and my mama took care of me right there on the spot, and I learned a valuable lesson.
You open your book with a confession. You expose yourself to the emotions of the reader. And would you read that passage about, it starts with the nightmare that your wife has, and then goes on to tell about you and Dr. Martin Luther King. You call it a shameful day in 1967.
Yes. After we settled in Atlanta with our two young sons, Darlene had a terrible nightmare that plagued her for 20 months until we moved from the South back to the West Coast in 1968. In this dream, she is always walking alone in a large city. As she rounds a corner, she sees me leaning against a building. I have been attacked by a group of redneck racists, castrated and left bleeding with our two young sons crying in fear as they cling to my legs. It was a recurring image of the South that haunted her for many years. She still remembers it with a sense of foreboding. One evening in 1967, my wife and I went out for a quiet dinner alone at the Hyatt Regency Hotel, located on one of the ubiquitous Peachtree Streets in Atlanta. We parked our car in the hotel's underground parking garage and had a pleasant dinner in a restaurant in the hotel. After dinner, we returned to the garage and waited for our car. Waiting with us were two separate groups of people, Martin Luther King Jr. and three or four well-dressed black people were on the other side of the car return area, and a group of four well-dressed white people, two men and two women, stood near us. I turned to Darlene and said, "Look over there, that's Martin Luther King." "Are you sure?" she asked. "Oh, yes, that's him," I said. At that moment, one of the two white men yelled something like, "Well, looky there, Billy, if it ain't the savior of the colored folks. I bet you he ate coon livers for supper." I looked at the men in disbelief as the other man yelled out an even more racist epithet. King and his party said nothing and stoically waited for their car as a barrage of racial slurs was hurled at them. King's car arrived first, and he and his party left without saying a thing or acknowledging the presence of the two white men. My wife and I said nothing during this dreadful encounter. We stood silently, observing a scene that I'm sure King experienced daily. Our car came after King's, and we left the garage in silence. We said nothing to King, we said nothing to the white men, and we said nothing to each other as we drove home. We were shocked and ashamed. I am still ashamed.
And you link those two stories, the nightmare and the incident.
Yes.
And I thought about those two things together, and My interpretation is that your wife sensed that if you made any moves to intervene, that those men would attack you.
That may have subliminally been in our minds in some form. I've thought about why I at least didn't say something, at least leave the man alone, let him leave in peace or something. But I didn't. What I really say is that there are moments in each of our lives where we are called to bear witness. And this was one of those moments for me, and I didn't do anything.
But I was also thinking of her point of view, that she wasn't a Southerner. She knew the stories, and she knew the danger that one could get into.
No, absolutely.
And that had you spoken up, she might have been in the situation that she was in her nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a, you know, it's not just black and white. It's always gray.
You know, of course.
And one does think of the consequences of one's actions. But I really appreciate that you told the story in all its complexities and that you included the nightmare, because that's, to me, that I could see it from her point of view, that would have put her in danger. But it's in those two pages. You've got it.
Yes. Well, you're absolutely
right.
It would be much less a story without the nightmare scene.
Right.
Yes.
Right. I noticed that in your writing of really, really difficult matter, like the bombing of the church in Birmingham, that you write it in a perfectly straightforward manner. No rhetorical flourishes. You're just telling what happened. And to me, that's the only way that a story like that can be told.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine embellishing it.
No, but if you had, it would have detracted.
Yes.
It's just, and it's not as though you were speaking journalism. You're still in a very literary mode, but you've got it down to just the barest. This happened, and then that happened, and then the reader sees it exactly as it happened.
Yes.
Without any comfort of literary flourishes. We face it the way it happened.
There's no comfort.
No. Well, it's a magnificent achievement, Waits. I just can't tell you how much it means to me to have this book. And I know that those people who are listening who haven't read it yet will want to get their hands on a copy and will want to read it. And thank you so much for all the work you did to write this story and to write it so beautifully and make it so easy for us to read it. And thank you so much for coming in and talking about it. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much.
Well, Rosemary, thank you so much. And thank you for your wonderful comments. You don't know how that warms the cockles of an author's heart.
The book is Our Southern Home. It's written by Waits Taylor, Jr., and it's available in bookstores, online, and we encourage you to get your hands on a copy.
Waits Taylor, Jr. and Rosemary Manchester. You can hear an extended interview and reading online at www.krcb.org/podcasts or subscribe to us on iTunes. You can experience Waits in person at Mendocino College in Ukiah on Thursday, October 18th at 7. Wayne Roden has been a violist with the San Francisco Symphony for over 30 years. He's played all over the world, including our own Green Music Center, where he looks forward to playing with the symphony this coming season. Wayne is also a vintner and a Southerner. I spoke with him recently about his musical career, but it was his life as an Alabamian that we'll feature here. These two men, Waits and Wayne, have not yet met, but it's interesting how their experiences resonate with each other. Here's Wayne Roden.
I think the first thing to say is that I grew up in a really unusual circumstance in Alabama, in that my father, who was a native of Alabama. In fact, on both sides of the family, we go back quite a few generations, at least five on both sides, maybe even longer. And so we really were native Alabamians. My father had been changed by his experience of being in the Army Air Corps in World War II and getting out and seeing, you know, the world in a larger way. And maybe it was more than that. There were innate things in him. Anyway, he was a very progressive person. And so I grew up quite liberal for being from Alabama. You know, I supported the idea of integration when it became an issue in the South, and I was one of a few in my high school class who did, or at least who said so openly. I mean, at the beginning, my father was, he had a very varied career. He worked as a school teacher. He worked for the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis during the polio epidemic. He went back to school and got a master's degree in English. He became an editor of the Alum News, the alumni paper at Auburn, and eventually he became the executive director of the Alabama Council on Human Relations, which was a moderate civil rights organization. So I really grew up with a very different take on things than I think was probably average, even though you can sense what my slant was on things that were happening in the South at the time. I would say that it was painful for me, even though I felt we deserved the opprobrium that was heaped upon us for things that happened. It was painful because I still essentially viewed myself as a Southerner, and actually still do. I kind of think of myself as an expatriate Southerner now, but I am at heart a Southerner. All the things from the South formed me. And I'm proud of some of those things, which is hard for some people to either understand, believe, or accept. But when I read somebody like Faulkner, that's speaking to my heart because he's talking about a place, an area, and things that I know about. But I will say, you know, on one occasion, my father took me along with some other people from Auburn. And we actually went to the beginning of the Selma March. Now, we weren't in the march itself, but we heard Walter Reuther speak and we heard Martin Luther King speak. And that was an amazing experience. And after that, we left and went home. They went on the march, which, of course, is famous. When we went to Selma that day, we happened to be sitting up in the balcony section of the church. And before the meeting had convened, there was a smell of smoke in the air. And the Birmingham bombings had not happened that long before that. And I was pretty skittish kind of person. I guess I still am. And I immediately had this panicky thought, you know, that somebody's going to bomb this place. And I actually had a second there where I wanted to bolt. Also, the other thing, and I believe this was, if I'm not mistaken, I haven't studied this stuff. I'm remembering it from that long ago, the horrible thing that happened to some of the people who came down to protest. Liuzzo, I believe the woman's name, Viola Liuzzo, was murdered. And, you know, those kind of things were horrifying and traumatizing. As far as my immediate family, of course, we talked about it because my father was very engaged and thought about this kind of thing, and eventually moderate kind of civil rights activities. Nothing ever affected us directly. I'm kind of amazed in a way that with his stance that nothing ever did happen, but it didn't. In my own family, there were people that I loved who were racist. I mean, they had racist attitudes or prejudiced attitudes, But they weren't horrible people. It's just that the prejudice came from a long time back and a lot of things that happened. And, of course, there were tensions and arguments at times in the family about issues and things like that. I think what I found the most difficult, though, was when I left the South, that there was a prejudice against me as a Southerner. Now, to people who are thinking more of what it's like to be a black person or some other group that where they are prejudiced against, I'm sure that the prejudice against a Southern white must seem quite, you know, not important. And in a certain sense, that's true. But it hurts, period. Because any time that you're prejudiced against, it's not fair. It's not right. And so, I mean, there's a kind of irony there that I came from ideas and a way of thinking that was at least progressive in the South, and yet I was by some few people presumed to be something that I wasn't. And so that's just one aspect of what happened back in those times that was difficult. Yeah. And I think probably I've always had a little chip on my shoulder about the fact that I'm from the South. And in typical fashion for me, I react defensively because it's like I understand what was disdained by people that weren't from the South, but I also understand what was great about the South, what was wonderful about the mm-hmm. South, the things in people that was good, even people that were sometimes prejudiced. Mm-hmm. And one last thing I would say is that I'm not going to try to paint this as something that it's not, because the Jim Crow South, the old segregated South, was very unequal society. But there was something that existed in the South, and that was that black people and white people knew each other. And that's something that I saw when I went other places in the country at other times that didn't exist. It was a huge thing. And what I've seen in the years, I don't go back that often, I don't stay that long, but I've seen a big improvement in the South in racial relations. I'm not saying it's perfect or great, but there is a big difference in my lifetime.
A reflection by Wayne Roden on his life as a Southerner. A full version of my conversation with Wayne, who has worked under the last four musical directors of the San Francisco Symphony, is available online with all of our podcasts at krcb.org/podcasts. We're going out with another violist, Ori Kam, playing the music of Telemann. Thanks for listening today. I'm Suzanne Lang.
And I'm Rosemary Manchester. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.